Bob.
Hi, my name is Bob. I'm Greg Propulsive over here in Food Ag.
Hi, Bob.
What I like to do with anybody that came from a broken home, raise your hand. And of those people, who feels that that's the reason why they're a compulsive person? Now, those who lived in a home that was very upsetting, the parents stayed together, but there was a lot of turmoil in the household. Who came from a family like that? And how many of you feel that that's might be the reason why you're compulsive? And how many people came from a happy family life? And how many of those feel that that's the reason why they're compulsive? I was at a meeting last week, and the person who was speaking had said that they felt that because their parents were divorced and that they felt like a ping pong ball going from one parent to the other, and they felt that was the reason why they were alcoholic. And I remembered feeling this just the opposite. Big squirrels in Woodbridge. I thought just the opposite. I thought that the reason why I was compulsive was because my parents should have got a divorce. And they stayed together, and there was turmoil in the house. So it just goes to prove that there's many different scenarios, but we're all sitting here. And one of the things that I learned through my recovery that it's important to remember what happened, but what am I going to do about it today? Because that's where I'm at. I'm in today. And I can look back at yesterday, and I can look forward to tomorrow, but I'm still going to be in today. And that's why a lot of times when I share, I sort of skip over my past. And tonight I felt maybe a little different. I have some pictures I'd like to pass around. This particular one was the summertime. And that February, I came into program. My neighbor took this picture and gave it to me. And I hadn't seen what I looked like. And I was planting pansies in the springtime. That's when that picture was taken. And I came into Overeaters Anonymous February 26, 1989. And I've never left. I've been in relapse a few times while in the fellowship. And where it started, I guess, was, you know, some of the pictures, it looks like around 12, 14 years old, I started putting on a lot of weight. And I was living down in Florida. We had moved from Jersey City down to Tampa. And I lived most of my life, my childhood in Tampa. And I always thought it was a pretty good family life. I mean, my father was alcoholic, so he wasn't around a lot. And my mother was a compulsive overeater. And I was the one who was trying to hold everybody together. And my brother was 6 years older than me. So I really never had too much, I don't remember too much of our interaction. Because I remember him working. And my mother and I would go to the beach. And I don't remember my brother being with us. And I remember my father was a distributor for Stella Dora cookies. And he had the whole central part of Florida from coast to coast, like from Tampa all the way over to Orlando. And he would make that route in 2 weeks. And we had a two-car garage that had cases and cases of cookies. And there were times when I remember my father would go out, and I'm going to talk about food, so... My father would go out in the garage and get a bag of cookies and bring them in the house. And he would take half, and I would take half, and we would put them in the bowl, and he would put coffee in his, and I would put milk in mine. And that's what I remember. I don't remember school. I don't remember other things that I did, but I remember the food. And I remember I had a hard time in school my whole life. I was left back in the second grade because I couldn't read good enough. And I just got through school with the skin of my teeth. D's and E's. A B was like, wow. You know, even in gym. I mean, I couldn't climb up the rope. I couldn't do chin-ups. And I thought I was obese, but I was like 200 pounds. And then anyway, we moved up here in 1966. My father lost his job because he was drinking. And we moved up here to Sayreville. And I finished my 11th grade and my 12th grade in Sayreville War Memorial High School. And then in 1968, I joined the Army because I had been working in a place called Steer Inn, which is like a McDonald's, but it was a small chain out of Philadelphia. And I was a night manager there, and two guys that were working with me were, like, they had robbed stores and stuff, and they had said they wanted to take the cigarette machine that was outside. And I says, all right. And they says, well, we'll give you the money, and we'll take the cigarettes. And I said, okay. So we brought it inside, disassembled it, and stored it up in the loft in the building. And the next day, I was questioned by the police if I knew anything, and I said, no, it was outside. And then, you know, I mean, I don't really notice it was outside. So the two guys that helped me, or that wanted to do it, they got put in jail for a gas station that they had robbed. And so then I started getting fear started coming into it, that I was going to get caught. And I went down to wherever you join. I joined the Army. And it took a couple of weeks. I had left that job, and I went to work at McDonald's. And then I went into service. And then, like, 3 weeks after I was in Fort Dix, my mother told me that the FBI came to our house looking for me, that they had found out that I was involved in it. And that was the end of it. I never heard anything ever since then. But that always stayed in my mind that, you know, that I did that. And I was afraid that I was going to get found out. So I spent 3 years in the service. And I spent 2.5 years in Germany in the Army. And I remember seeing, we had people from Germans that would come in and do KP work. And I remember this guy, he was huge. And he would go from table to table to table, eating what was ever left over from all the GIs that were in there. And I remember watching him and thinking, that could be me. Because I had to sign a waiver that I would lose 50 pounds in basic training or they'd kick me out of the Army. And I remember my mother came to visit me in Fort Dix, and she brought me a thing of lasagna. And the drill sergeant said, oh, you can't have that. And so my mother says, well, what am I going to do with it? He says, well, I'll take it. And I couldn't have it because I was on this diet. And if I went off the diet and gained weight, they would kick me out. So anyway, so I did basic training in AIT, which is I learned how to be an auto mechanic. And then I got sent to Germany. And at that time, 1 week, what they did was, like, you would be a certain week number. Like, every week they had a different class kind of thing. And 1 week went to Vietnam, the next week went to Germany, the next week went to Vietnam, the next week went to Korea, the next week went to Vietnam, the next week was stateside. And it was a pattern, just kept going the same way. And I was scheduled to go to Vietnam and in basic, and I got pneumonia. And it put me back 1 week, which was to go to Germany. So the class that I was in wound up going to Germany. And and I remember going to Germany and having a time of my life. I mean, it was really good. I had a car. I had freedom. I was in my own room. I had it made. And because a lot of them slept like six or eight guys in one room. And I remember a lot of times you wouldn't eat in the mess hall, because in the beginning of the month the food would be good food. By the end of the month their money was running out, and so you get all this garbage that, you know. And so like the first of the month you get steak and chicken and stuff like that, and then at the end of the month you'd be getting hot dogs and hamburgers. So anyway, so I found that going to the EM club, which is the enlisted man's club, you could get whatever you wanted, you know, as long as you pay for it. And then also you could go outside to German and get whatever you wanted there. And I had freedom that I never had at home. Not that my parents were that you couldn't have something, but I just never felt free. Like, I was completely on my own. I was responsible for my own stuff. And I felt free. And I often relate it to, like, being in college, too. I mean, it's a freedom that you get from it, which gives you a little bit more responsibility, too. And then when I got out of the Army, I went home. And a friend of mine was going down to Florida, and he had an extra flight ticket. And he asked me if I wanted to go, and I said, sure. So I went down. This was like 3 days after I got back after 2.5 years in Germany. I go down to Florida. I come home, and after 2 weeks of being down in Florida, and I find out my mother moved out, and they wound up getting divorced. Now, while I was in that situation, it was chaotic. My mother was a food addict, and my father was an alcoholic, and my father was Italian, and my mother's German. And so there was a constant conflict, and they were both the youngest in the family. So my mother expected, because my mother grew up without a father, my mother expected my father to do all the guy stuff, you know, like cutting the grass and hanging pictures and doing the carpet, you know, whatever needed to be done. She had expectations of him doing that. And my father was the baby of the family. And being raised in an Italian family where my grandfather didn't speak English, my aunts took care of my father and would lay his clothes out for him. You know, that's the way the Italian family was. And my mother wasn't ready for that. So there was always that conflict and turmoil in the house. And so they got divorced. And then in 74, well, actually in 72, I met my wife. 74, I got married. 1979. Well, 1977, I bought my first house. 1979, my first daughter was born, Amy. And 1980, my second daughter was born. My oldest daughter is born in January. My youngest daughter is in November. And they're like 18 months apart. And when my oldest daughter... My oldest daughter was around 10 years old. It was like in 88. Around 88, maybe just before I came into program in 89, I was watching a football game. And you know how kids are. They get in front of the TV and block the TV. Yeah. Well, this is a football game. I says, Amy, get out of the way. She wouldn't get out of the way, and I chased her upstairs to give her a spanking. And she locked herself in the bathroom, locked the door. And across from that door is another door, and that's a door into a bedroom, but we use it as a like playroom and stuff for the kids. And we had a TV in there, and I was watching the game and waiting for her to come out. And I got this flash of when I was a kid, and my father would chase me in the bathroom. He would leave me alone. He would just go away until I came out, and then he would do whatever he had to do, whether it was give me a spanking or yell at me or whatever he did. And I had this flashback, and I said, you know, this kid's not going to get away with that. And so I ran across the room, and I busted the door in. And she must have been standing right behind the door, because when the door opened, it knocked her on her rear end. And I'm looking at her, this 10-year-old, and I'm saying, you know, there's something wrong here. This isn't what we do with children. And I started going to therapy and to find out what was going on. And my therapist, well, how do you feel? And I says, well, I feel like a, you know how a hamster gets in that little wheel, runs and runs and runs and runs and gets out, and he's in the same place. I says, that's how I feel. I feel as though I'm running and I'm out of breath and I'm in the same place. I can't get out of this place. And so she says, well, you know, she gave me that sheet with the, you know, if you answer more than 7 or 8 of these, then probably you're a compulsive overeater. And so, of course, I answered most of them. But she also did it with a perfectionist. It's for a perfectionist. If you do these things, you're most likely a perfectionist. And I never saw myself as a perfectionist, you know. But then when she started explaining to me what that means, I started saying, yeah, you know, I never finish anything. I always leave it undone. She says, well, you do that because you don't want anybody to think that you're finished. You're always leaving that little out of that, oh, what happened there? Oh, I'm not finished yet. I'm working on that. You know, I never finished anything. And so it moved on with that, and she recommended that I either go to Overeaters Anonymous or Adult Children of Alcoholics. And I knew somebody that had come to OA. And so I asked her if she would come with me, and we did. We went to that Sunday night Edison meeting, February 26, 1989. And I walked into the room, and at that time it was a little different there. The wall that's there wasn't there, and we would have the circle around there. And we there was 2 seats, and so we sat in those 2 seats that were available. And it just so happened it was right next to the leader of the meeting. That's probably why those 2 seats are available. But anyway, so Jerry sat next to the speaker, and I sat next to her. And so the leader said, we're going to do a round robin. We'll go around, and everybody gets to share something. And he said, the topic I'd like to throw out is, what brought you to the meeting today? And so Jerry shared, and then I'm supposed to share. And I says, well, my therapist said that I should come to an OA meeting, and that's why I'm here. And so after the meeting was over, somebody came up to Jerry and says, you know, I'd like to be your sponsor. Oh, okay. So I'm sitting there waiting. Nobody comes and asks me. So right off the bat, I get a resentment. You know? So then we left the meeting, and on the way back, I said to her, you know, they talk about control, you know, that you have no control. And I said, I got a lot of control. I go on diets and off diets. She says, no, that's not what they're talking about. They're talking about control over the food. Once you ingest certain foods, it has a tendency to, you tend to react to that. So anyway, I says, well, why don't we come back next week? She said, okay. So I picked her up, and she lived in Plainfield, and I live in North Plainfield, and we went to Edison. And, you know, we were at the meeting and stuff, didn't share anything, but just listen. And then on the way back, we talked. I don't remember what we said, but I said, you know, I think I'm going to keep going. You know, I says, are you interested? And she says, yeah, sure. So she has a sponsor and I don't. You know. So she says, well, maybe one day you should think about getting a sponsor, you know, because they keep saying, come back and get a sponsor. So there was a character that used to come to Edison named Frankie G. And he always talked, made everybody laugh. And He was a bicycle messenger in New York. He would get off the train in Newark with his bike. Somebody would usually pick him up and bring him to the meeting. Because I used to go to a meeting on Thursday night in Union. And they would bring him there after all day in the summer on a bicycle. And I wound up asking him one day at Edison, what do you look for in a sponsor? I think it was the fourth meeting I went to. And he says, well, call me in the morning at 9 o'clock. I says, well, I don't know if I can do that. You know, I don't get up until 11 o'clock because I was working nights. I said, is there another time that I can call you? He says, yeah, call me 9 o'clock in the morning. So for 3.5 years, I called him 9 o'clock in the morning. I told him what I was going to... I didn't tell him my food because we weren't doing that. I was doing 301. I was doing 3 meals a day with nothing in between. And I wound up calling him, and he would say, okay, we were doing the 21 writings. And he'd say, okay, read me what you wrote. And I read what I wrote to him. He said, all right, hold on. And then he'd come back and he'd read me. He said, okay, write this down, the next writing. I write the writing down. And he said, hold on. A few more minutes, he'd come back. He had somebody else on the line. We were, you know, that's my second resentment. So I worked with him for 3.5 years, and then I moved on to somebody else. And he was instrumental because he didn't drive, so I would go to Bloomfield, pick him up on a Saturday morning, go all the way up to Bloomfield, pick him up, and then drive him all the way down to Sayreville. Because there was a Parlin meeting on Saturday mornings that we would go to, and then after the meeting we would go to the diner. Then after the diner I'd have to drive him all the way back home again. So it was like an all-day affair. Well, one night he called my house around 11:30, and he says, I don't have a ride. I'm stranded. Can you give me a ride? And I jumped out of bed. I got dressed. I went. And my wife is saying, where are you going? Oh, Frankie needs a ride, you know, the codependent. So I drove over to pick him up and took him up to Bloomfield and came home. And, you know, I was willing to go to any length for him. And I put him on this pedestal. And I learned that by experience that it's not healthy to do that. And so, of course, you know, my behavior is all or nothing. So I either put them up on a pedestal or I put them down on the floor. Yeah, there's no in between, yeah. And that's what I've learned in the fellowship is that I can't put anybody in that place. You know, when I hear people say, oh, I have the best sponsor in the world, it's like, well, you know, I don't sponsor to try and make somebody absent. I just sponsor because I want to stay absent. And that's been my truth, is that working with others is the one way that I know that I'm going to stay in this fellowship. Because it says in working with others, it says, practical experience shows that nothing will so much ensure immunity from drink as intensive work with other alcoholics. It works when other activities fail. This is our 12th suggestion. Carry this message to other addicts. You can help when no one else can. You can secure their confidence when others fail. Remember, they are very ill. Life will take on a new meaning. To watch people recover, to see them help others, to watch loneliness vanish, to see a fellowship grow up about you, to have a host of friends. This is an experience you must not miss. We know you will not want to miss it. Frequent contact with newcomers and with each other is the bright spot of our life. And that's why the tools are important. Because if I don't go to meetings, I don't meet people. I don't share with people. If I don't use the telephone, I don't have contact with people. And working with others is vital to my recovery. And carrying the message is what God wants me to do. You know, before I started to share, I asked God to give me the words. I don't direct my thinking. I just, this is the way I want to, you know, go, but then I think, you know, whenever I make plans, I make plans and God laughs. You know, so why do it? And, you know, it's real important for me to stay focused on what God's will for me is for today. And in 1995, I went to a big book study in Hackettstown, and I met somebody named Howard from Berkeley Heights. And he told me about a meeting in Berkeley Heights. And 5 years, not that I want to rush, 5 years later I go up there and I hear the message that he's carrying. You know, it says in the book, sometimes slowly, sometimes quickly. Yeah. And we're very unorganized. So, you know, these are all things that I listen to. So I went up to Berkeley Heights and I heard the message that they were giving about the process in the big book, doing the back to basics. And I started getting other people in OA, because that was an AA meeting, getting people involved. And, you know, we did a back to basics in OA. And it's been really an exciting thing for OA and for me to see that process grow within the fellowship and to see people recover. And hear people say, you know, I've been in the fellowship for 10 years and I've never seen that in a book. And it's amazing how that process that they do brings out so much information out of the book. And it's really, for me, it's an exciting thing. And I'm really blessed to be part of it. And for today, I live in the steps, and I belong to the fellowship, and that's an important thing for me. So, thanks for listening.
This time we ask if anybody has a question they'd like to ask Bob.
How do you work step 10?
I've always been told that step 10 is a daily inventory. In other words, for me, if I see that I'm angry or resentful, or if I talk to somebody with a short voice, that I need to look at that and do an inventory. So some people do a 10-step inventory, which is there are sheets where you could go over it on a daily basis. You know, where was I? Dishonest, resentful, fearful. But what I do is I just look at my day. I try and do it throughout the day. I don't just leave it for either in the morning or at night. But I do work at trying to make amends right away. I mean, there's been times where I've heard things come out of my mouth and I'll say, you know, that's not true. And then I'll make amends right away. The hardest place to do that is at home. That's the hardest place. Because I don't want to say I'm sorry or that I'm wrong. To people in the fellowship, it's not bad because I know someday they're going to be saying it to me. But at home, I don't get that. I get, you know, it's all my fault. So, but that's how I do it. I mean, you know, the book has it laid out in there that the 10th step is to do a daily inventory. So that's what I try and do. I try and use the sheets because it keeps it simple for me. Where was I at fault? What part do I play in it? When I'm angry at somebody, it's usually because I'm not getting what I want or what I think I need.
So. Yeah, so when you did your first 4 steps, was it very difficult? Did you stall the process during it?
Which 4 step?
Your very first inventory 4 step in LA.
That was a life history. That was like 87 pages. And it was different than what I do now. But what I like about the back to basics is that it gives you a process to work. What I did was, there was 10 emotions, if I can remember them. Theft, fear, anger, gluttony, resentment, and sexual harms. And you wrote on each one, like, where had I stole stuff? I tried to rack my brain of all the things I had stolen. How can you do that? And then it didn't tell you to do anything with that information, which is why I like the process that I do now, because now it's, when I share it with my sponsor, it's like, all right, well, what part did you play in that theft? What do you think that theft was about? And we have a discussion about it. Where the other one, it was more like just purging all the information, but not changing. There was nothing to change. I was still doing the same thing, but I told somebody. And it wasn't as... Maybe at the time it's all I could have done. Maybe I wouldn't have been ready for the back to basics.
When you've done step nine, what has helped you to persevere and follow through?
To be honest with you, listen to somebody else when they talk about getting ready to do their ninth step and they have to make amends to somebody that they hadn't seen in 12 years and they're walking down the street and that person crosses their path and they make amends to that person. Knowing that God wants us to do it and when we're ready, we'll bring that person to us. And the other thing that I noticed the last time I did it, once I started the process, once I started making amends, it seemed like I was compulsive about doing it. I took that compulsive behavior and applied it to making the amends. Now, I wanted to make amends to everybody like Dr. Bob did right away, today. You know, I want to do it all. And I had to learn patience.
Bob, do you use any other literature besides the big book?
No.
How did you develop your food plan?
Kay Shepherd. I actually went to Food Addicts Anonymous around the same time, 95. It was real new at that time. That's Food Addicts Anonymous. And I started going there along with coming here. And they used Kay Shepherd's book as though it was the big book because it gave you the phenomenon of cravings for food. And what the, you know, I don't know if you're aware, but in alcoholism, the acetone is what builds up in your system, and it takes a certain amount of time to for the body to process that, and that's why if you keep drinking, you get drunk, you know, more drunk. And it's the same thing with us. When you eat sugar, wheat, or flour, it has a tendency to affect the serotonin level in the body, and that's what throws off that mechanism that tells us that we're, you know, enough's enough. So, you know, food addiction is also a mental, it does something to our mental being. But that book is the food plan that I go by today. Yes. And that was the first food plan that I called in my food, and I weighed and measured my food. Up until then, I was doing 3 meals a day with nothing in between, no sugar. But then I had to go another level. And I'm in the process now of getting that serenity and that peace of mind to move into another direction now. So.
When you're doing the 3 meals a day, how many calories a day was you taking in? You know?
I don't go by calories. And I don't do a diet.
How do you sponsor people in OA?
Tough. No, you know, it's funny, we were talking about that today at a meeting that I went to. I do it different now than I did when I first came in, and even 5 years ago, because I had a 2.5 year relapse and my concept sort of changed because the person I was working with was very gentle. And I learned patience and gentleness from her. Because I was like, well, how could you not be absent? You know, but then when I couldn't get absent, she was patient with me. And I think I've become less rigid. I mean, when I was sponsoring before, if, you know, I would give you a 15-minute time frame. If you called me within that time, that was all the time you had. Like, I would give somebody from, say, 5 o'clock in the morning till 5:15. If they called me up at 5:15, I would say, well, call me tomorrow, because that time slot was used up. Or if they would call me, I would let anybody call me any other time if I was home, but that was their time. But if they were having a problem or something, they want to call me at night, that's okay. But if they didn't call me, if they called me at 6, I would tell them, you got to call me tomorrow. And if they called and said, well, I don't have a writing, I says, well, then call me back in 5 minutes with your writing. I was very, very rigid. There was no black and white in it. And today I'm a lot different. It's like, you want to do the writing, do the writing. You don't want to do the writing, don't do the writing. It's your recovery, not mine. I do my writing every day, and I turn my food over every day. So, no, it's what works for me, but it may not work for somebody else. Yeah. I've had a lot of people leave program because I was rigid. They said, you know, well, I don't need this. And I realize now that that's probably more the reason. And I try real hard to push work in the steps, the back to basics, through the sheets, because I think it makes it so simple. And I encourage people to go to back to basics. Yeah.
Well, thanks so much for coming and sharing.